John. Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Greetings. How are you?
Well, I'm living in the pandemic.
Yeah.
Like I kind of use it as a sarcastic remark.
Oh, yes.
I used to say living in the in paradise. Well, now paradise is a pandemic.
Yeah. I hear you. I had a good omen this morning.
Oh, nice. What is it?
Yeah. Well, I had a trepidation about this event today. Usually I'm wildly looking forward to these events, but this one has, I don't know, an element of risk I usually don't feel. And then I saw this lovely lady. I had my yoga mat. I was walking down the street and a lovely lady, a black lady my age, she had a mask, I had a mask, we were socially distancing, but she said, oh, may I ask you a question? I said, sure. She said, did you just go to a yoga class? And I said, no, I just went to the playground with my mat and I do some exercises there. And she was looking for a yoga class. And I said, well, you know, if you look online, you can see lots of yoga classes going on. She says, but I want to be around people. I'm really tired of being isolated. And I said, yeah, I hear you. And then she recited a poem. I don't know what the poem was. I didn't recognize it. But what I did notice was, oh, this is a very literary person. And that she, here she is talking to a stranger and quoting poetry. I really admire that in a person because I'm a poetry lover also. And I just felt she was just tuning into this this loneliness. And I said, well, you're not alone. You know, many of us are feeling this. And then, you know, I went on my way, she went on her way. So it was just an exchange between two strangers. But in that few minutes we had that conversation, I felt very okay. I think this proposal, getting together and about cultural somatics and working with the white body supremacy with that theme in mind. I just took that exchange as like a green light. You know, this is a good thing to do.
I'm glad you did, John. I have a similar reservations about not necessarily talking about it with you, but with other people, you know, because as the book lays out, you know, part of the difficulty comes because we don't work on the trauma inside our bodies to talk about it. And so a kind of thing that I think parallels your little omen is I took notice 2 days ago that I wanted to have this conversation in a certain place. So I'm actually at Back to the Grind in the basement. And why that is significant for me is many, many years ago when this place was part of my recovery coming here and stuff, for about 7 years, I taught a very loose form of mindful meditation practice that was based heavily on being, I'm the mentor, I'm not the God, but I'm a mentor. And really laying that out and trying to share that with people. And I'm just, for myself, I think that was really interesting how my intuition guided me to get in the earth to help me heal in a way. I mean, I wasn't locked in I wasn't in a casket, you know. There was a doorway and stuff, but it was interesting to meditate under here why Darren, the owner, is pounding on the coffee grounds and doing things. And you know, it wasn't one of those really nice silent retreats where you hear birds and stuff. No, we had to work with other kinds of sounds.
Uh-huh. And I like the way your voice sounds in there. It sounds like a very resonant space you're in.
Oh, yeah. And that's another reason I think that you tuned into, I think, on a very below the surface, mm-hmm. you know, in the body, which is very nonlinear, nonverbal, at least. But, you know, it's something real is what I experience about that.
I'm going to hold on just a second. I want to check and see if I got a message from Seth. I know sure. I sent him a link, but he isn't here yet, and he's usually on time. Let me see if I can find him. I'll be right back.
Okay.
I hope he didn't have trouble getting on Zoom, because that's happened.
I had I had a little trouble, but hopefully he figures it out if he is having trouble.
Okay. Yes. He left a message. Let's see. Just trying to let you know. I may be a few minutes late. Okay. I'm biking home at the moment from the other end of Queens. Oh, oh my God. All right.
Okay. I'm glad he signaled us what's going on.
Yes. And this message just was sent 5 minutes ago. So I think he's on his way. Let me let him. Okay. We will wait for you.
Cool. Yeah. It will be good to have Seth on board.
Yeah. Okay. Now, can you see me? I can see you, but okay.
Yeah, I can see you.
Okay. Just trying to. Okay, there I am. Okay.
Yeah, I really like that link of that podcast with Michael Garfield that you sent of the two individuals.
Oh, wasn't that great? Yeah.
Yeah, and I've read one of Tata's, you know, cultural semantic paradox. I just read that finished reading that about 10 minutes ago.
Oh, is it an article by him or is it a
book? Yeah, on his personal site called Cultural Paradox. It was listed on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
I'm looking forward to exploring more of him and his partner. Dare so high.
Yeah.
They're working with what they call cultural semantics, and Tada, I think that's how his name is pronounced. He mentioned this book that you and I have studied, Risma Mannequin, My Grandmother's Hands, and so I feel like this might be the beginning of a kind of movement called cultural semantics. I'm not sure of that, but I think that it comes out of a sort of a way of thinking about trauma and a sophistication. Because when I was studying therapy as a practitioner 30 years ago, they were, I think, practicing really bad things. For people with post-traumatic stress, you do not ask them, well, how did it feel when they were raping you? How did it feel when they were like, you know, sticking your head under the water? I mean, you don't do it. They had this whole crazy idea that reactivating trauma actually changes trauma. Actually, it just gets harder wired in the nervous system. And as a trauma, as someone who has had a lot of trauma, I found those, you know, I would go to these workshops and I would do these trainings and I just would ask a very simple question. It's like, well, when am I going to start feeling better? Which was like, oh no, this takes for the rest of your life. They had this really dumb, these really not dumb ideas, but this whole insight oriented orientation where you just get a better understanding of it and everything is fine. And that's a very cognitive based orientation, which I think.
Yeah. Very mental, rational without acknowledging, you know, your head is attached to a body. It is attached. There is a nervous system. And you're right. They were doing it poorly until such time other things came along, like neurobiology, more openness to talking around the body. Peter Levine's work started to change things.
That's right.
And
Reggie Ray.
And Reggie Ray from the spiritual point of view. And but I love Reggie Ray. Yeah, it's body-based work, and I love Reggie Ray's work. But because of some of my work, maybe I'm just not paying attention, but, you know, we brought it up. The ego needs to, the way they look at the ego, sometimes the language is bashing the ego. And I don't think that's the way to, as Resman would say, settle our bodies.
Right.
Because I don't know if you, in my experience, I'm marking 35 years ago this year, I probably began my own, began my intense recovery work from trauma from before, but also from attempting suicide, hanging myself. And now I, you know, looking back, I can see was, you know, the trauma of my ego comes through, it is developed through the survival instinct, let's face it, but it becomes very cognitive. And then how do we, that's one thing I learned with good forms of meditation that were body-based without demonizing the ego, of feeling that tension as an, you might say, adult now, of the way the ego was formed through, you know, good, bad, you know, instinctual responses, which is not to demonize those responses, but have a better relationship. It's like getting on the line of development of how our ego defense system actually can support us, but it does have limitations.
Could you say a little more about that? A little bit more about the ego? Yeah.
Well, you know, the ego is basically, from what I understand of working with Gebser.
Hey, Seth.
Oh, Seth.
How you doing?
Good. How about you, buddy?
Doing good. You have some nice dramatic lighting, Michael.
Yeah.
He's in the basement somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm about 12 feet underground. I felt that it was significant that I embrace the soma of the earth as well as my own body.
Sounds appropriate.
Did you just get out of the shower? You look like you're dripping.
Yeah, I just got home and I was sweating, so I just threw some water on myself and.
Great. I got your message. I got your message. So, great. Welcome aboard.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I'm so glad that the three of you, all the three of us, are here. Michael was just—we were just talking shop and talking about working with trauma and our personal histories of working with trauma, and. I think this episode today, I'm pretty open to whatever happens, but I would like to think about this outline that I sent to both of you.
John?
Yes, Michael, yes.
Could I finish my thought about what you
asked? Oh, please. Okay, I meant to get back around to that, but I just wanted to bring Seth into the mix.
Yeah, that's fine. I just, before I forget that thought, I want to...
Please.
The thing is, in studying Gebser, he helped me understand that the ego, because it's a perspective, came online during mental rational. Okay? And it mental rational came online to give us a perspective, but it has roots in our survival, our biological survival part of us. And that's not bad or good. That's intelligent. There's intelligence, but mental rational comes along and gives us our own perspective on that. And then we have to, I think what we're learning, we can get traumatized and the ego freaks out, like my experience, and gets hypervigilant. But then I had to, the fortunate out of my trauma is to develop a new relationship of how I can have an ego without being identified in such a way that it's strictly informed from the fight or flight or freeze. Not that it's not important, but it's not the only way to gauge my response. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes plenty of sense. And it makes me remember that I've been studying alternatives to those traditional cognitive ways of working with trauma, like Peter Levine and like Reggie Ray.
Polyvagal nerve, you've said.
Right. Stephen Porges on the polyvagal theory. And And I also, Seth and I have worked a lot with clean language, which comes out of David Grove's work. And he was working with Trump. He was working with Vietnam vets. He was working with people who had been raped. So people who had been subjected to a lot of violence. And his technique, which we've been studying and we presented to folks here, and to yourself, working with metaphor. And I believe there's a relationship between cultural somatics and the different polyvagal theory and metaphor, working with metaphor. Because as David observed, and as I observed, as David was working with me, and as I've shared this with others, there's, if you go directly to, well, what did that feel like? Well, it really sucked. I really hated it. It was horrible. You just end up re-traumatizing a person. But if you enter into, and that was like what? Then you can create a metaphorical, a metaphor and have a relationship to the metaphor rather than repeating the traumatic episode and reactivating it in your nervous system, which actually just creates a kind of a no exit kind of sensation in the body. So that's what I'm hoping that today, Seth, with Seth's guidance here, I do feel his support, and with your support also, Michael, I believe we can do something different besides just do the talking heads routine, which we're also familiar with. Everyone sitting on the, going on the YouTube and looking at these horrific scenes, and then they have these panel discussions, which stay very from the neck up, you know. Not that they aren't having intense emotions, they are, but they're not being, we're not embracing that aspect. And so the dialogues become very shrill and very over the top and extremely, and I'm sensitive to the fact that, you know, catharsis is not necessarily leads to anything but more catharsis. You know, you can yell and scream and cry all you want to, but that doesn't change much unless you're bringing that mindfulness, that attentiveness, that sense of the wholeness of the person, their sense of their, and that's why I hope we can start with a little bit of anchoring safety. So that we can anchor safety.
Good.
When you're feeling safe, that's like what, Michael? And when you're feeling safe, Seth, that's like what?
To me, that ties into that instinctual, the very base instinctual safety, danger, duality.
That's
right. And so I'm on board. I'm just going to add something that I learned. I also had to learn that safety can be a trap. You know, so I'm just going to add that that's a trap that we have to be careful of too. But you've always been good, John, with your language of safe enough. And I've always appreciated that, because some places I've been into, the type of safety they have, I'll just say it, it's not safety, it's prison.
That's right. And that would be, to complete that, the whole idea is to create a sense of safety, a robust, unique to you sense of safety, so that you can then explore these areas of our social psychic space without re-traumatizing ourselves or each other, so that we can then deal and oscillate. I think I'm getting this from the cultural somatics folks. We can oscillate from safety to risk to scary. We can oscillate back and forth. And in that oscillation, we don't go over the, we don't hit a threshold and go over the threshold. We don't go under the threshold. We find that zone in the middle where you can deal.
That triterating, you know, where you just go just enough, you know, just enough so that you actually are resetting the nervous system.
That's exactly. And so I'm confident today with the two of you guys and myself, because I've observed in both of you an ability to co-regulate, which is another technical term, but it's basically...
Yeah, it's a beautiful term, actually.
You can regulate yourself. You can also regulate with another person. So when someone hits a threshold and goes over the threshold, or someone's giving you a double message, you're able to be with that. And being able to oscillate without, you know, going over the top or without freezing or, you know, going into dissociation.
Yeah, and you actually learn better ways to protect yourself in the midst of helping other people.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And Seth, you're nodding your head.
I see that.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so I get a sense that there's some agreement here.
Yes.
How about you, Seth? Is there anything you want to share or reflect upon or?
Not necessarily, other than that I'm excited to do what we're ever going to do on this call. I haven't memorized his name yet because it's a foreign name to me, but that psychologist.
Reza? Yep. Rezma?
Yeah.
Rezma Manakin, I believe is his name.
That's right, yeah. Oh, I was listening to him on my bike ride around town just an hour ago, and I was very excited about what he's saying, and after listening, I'm like, man, I have to get this book. So I'm psyched to be working in his spirit.
Great. So yep. We're working with, I got the title of the book from the video which Michael sent to me. And I picked up on this from Michael. Nice. And then I listened to the other cultural somatic guys that was quoted earlier, Dare Sohei and Tazda Azumi, and they referenced Rezma's work. So that's why before you got on this call, we sort of were thinking maybe this is the beginning of a new kind of movement, cultural very somatics.
Cool. Very cool. Yeah.
I felt maybe, I don't know exactly how to do this, but I'd like to do like a clean start maybe. Would that be okay with you?
Go for it, buddy. Go for it.
If you want to just give me 1 second, I'm just going to grab my power cord so my laptop doesn't die.
Okay.
Right,
okay, great. I tend to be very procedural sometimes. I can do a free-for-all on occasion, and I like free-for-alls, but I also feel like a little procedure at the beginning has great benefits so that it does, John. Something to reflect on.
You know? It does, John. I just think sometimes we're mirror opposites. I go for free fall and then procedural.
Right.
So if anything else, I enjoy the oscillation.
That's right. I do too. Because if you're just doing procedural, it gets really boring. But I think procedure with an openness can create a healthier kind of response, because too often people just go into conversational mode, which basically just is sort of a feel-good thing, and it's also kind of protective thing. Well, let's not go too deep. Let's stay away from that. Right. Let's keep it in the little box we're all, you know, on the same page. So having said all that, Michael, for this session, our session today to be really useful for you, mm-hmm. this session will be like what?
It will be like sitting with friends on the beach, having a beer, but with the purpose of engaging in some matter of fact. What the fuck is going on with the world?
Okay. Sitting with friends on the beach with a beer and what the fuck is going on with the world?
And yeah, it's a serious conversation.
And for this session to be like sitting with friends on the beach, having a serious conversation, you will be like what?
I will be like an adult that has a childlike wonder about being about this comp this talk an adult being childlike about this conversation.
An adult being childlike about this conversation. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Seth, do you want to go next, or would you like to lead me into the into this clean start?
John, for this session to be really useful for you, that would be like what?
It would be a shared adventure.
And it would be a shared adventure. And when a shared adventure and be really useful to you, you would be like what?
I would be like a skydiver.
Like a skydiver. And I'll also ask, and when a skydiver and a shared adventure and be really useful to you, we would be like what?
We, can we include you?
If you'd like.
Well, I would say we would be like a convocation or a collection or a committee of love warriors. We know how to fight for a worthy cause on behalf of others. And that's a form of very deep love, a warriorship that isn't about domination or manipulation, but of protection, of being able to protect others who may not be able to protect themselves.
Nice.
And love warriors, who know how to fight for a worthy cause. Excellent.
And can I ask you, Seth, about for this session today with together with us, for this to be really useful for you, this session will be like what?
I suppose this session would be mutual, or let's not say that, a shared growth experience.
A shared what?
Shared growth experience.
Shared growth.
For some reason, I like that better than mutual, because mutual to me suggested that we all have to grow, like let's all grow, but just if any of us grow at all, we can share in that person growing, or we can grow together. It's totally open.
That's good. I like that.
And for you to, for this session to be a shared growth experience, you will be like what?
What comes to mind is that I would be like a Rosicrucian. Because their whole ideal is, they go out into the world and they wear the clothes of whatever is appropriate, whatever part of the world is appropriate. And they work to heal the sick or free.
A Rosicrucian, healing the sick. And what was that last part? I didn't quite catch it. I'm sorry.
For free.
For free.
Gratis.
I got it. Okay. Now maybe you guys let me know. I feel like we have really accomplished the first part of the exercise that I had hoped for us to complete today, which was to create safety, to explore white body supremacy through the photograph of the 1920 lynching and do some clean language around that. My question would be, and you could change this or improve on this, Seth, but when you view photo of the Duluth lynching, what happens to your body? Which is a slight difference from the way I think Resma presents this exercise. I don't know, you haven't read the book, Seth, so, but I'll go into a little bit what Resma does, and then maybe I could like offer a clean language version of what Resma I think is doing. I think the intention behind his work and what a clean language presentation would be are very overlapping. And then maybe once we go through that, we could then open it up to like an open frame. And whatever comes up, what has ever come up, we can share it there or modify it or, you know, be critical about something. Take it wherever we want. So does that sound okay with you guys? I just want to be sure I got everyone on board.
100% feels
okay. Great. So I'm just going to share with you. Have you all had a chance to look at the photo?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Quite a bit.
Have you looked at it,
Seth? Did you send it to me, John? I didn't see that.
Okay, if you go to, you could Google it. It's the 1920 Duluth lynching. And there's a, if you go to the Wikipedia page, it may pop up and you'll see the photograph. It's a famous photo because it was actually turned into a postcard that people, do you see it?
Turned into a postcard? I see it.
1920 Duluth, D-U-L-U-T-H, I believe, lynching.
Minnesota.
Have you found it yet?
Yep, found it.
Okay, great. So, and since we're recording this, and anyone who watches this, I don't want to do any screen sharing. I think anyone who wants to watch, they can watch our conversation with or without the photo, but it's cool. Their choice.
I like that.
Because I want to be very respectful of anyone who may be participating as an observer of our encounter here, that they can enter into the weave of this however way they want to. So I think if we look at that photo, shall we start with you, Seth? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Since this is fresh for you, I'm gonna respond. First of all, I'm just gonna ask. You have to excuse me if I'm a little bit verklempt here. He said, as you look at the picture, what does your body experience? Where do you feel constriction or release? What other sensations does your body experience? What parts of your body want to fight? Which parts want to flee or turn away? And then he goes on to say, now look at the 24 or so white bodies that are posed around the lynched black bodies. Look at the expression on each man's face. What do you imagine he experiences in his body? What might he be feeling and thinking? And what might he be smelling, hearing, seeing? And then he goes on to ask more questions. So he's asking for an imaginal experience. So it's not just looking at the white men, it's going inside and imagining what it would be like to be in that.
Right.
That person's body. Mm-hmm. So that's his approach, and I applaud him for this. I think this is a very good approach. But I just want to ask a few clean questions, so that I don't impose any pre-given sort of conclusion on whatever may be happening. Okay, you know all this clean philosophy. So does Michael. But I always feel like I have to repeat it because it's helpful for me so that I can use clean language. It creates safety for me so I don't get sucked into the vortex of another person.
Yeah.
And when, Seth, you view the photo, what happens to your body?
Let me think about this. I have to like look at it and then look away from it to pay attention to me because I can't do them both at the same time. I'm feeling like something like this happening, kind of like coming inward and down. I guess it's a pressure. And then at the bottom, it becomes a nausea in my stomach.
An inward and pressure and nausea in your stomach. And then what happens?
Then there's kind of a, well, there's a vacancy of thought. Nothing's really going on up here. There's kind of like a, I guess, like a radiating anxiety also, something like this.
And the vacancy of thought and a radiating anxiety. Yeah. And when vacancy of thought and radiating anxiety what would you like to have happen?
I'm out of a headache also. It's weird, I don't know why. Now that I'm looking at the picture again, kind of see it like depicting the feelings I just described, almost like the people in the center feel like this contraction I just explained into the center of me, and then the people on the outside feel like this radiating anxious circle. I forgot your question though.
Yeah. And the white men, there are only white men in this picture, besides the three lynched black men. But the white, if you could enter into the white body of one of these persons, what would you know from that white person's body about the three black men who were lynched?
Well, so like, I look, there's so many faces in this image. And so I felt like I needed to pick one because there's a lot of different human experiences happening. And I picked one and went into that phase. And from there, I didn't really learn much of anything about the black men who were lynched.
Just okay. Well, what do
you,
what do you know? Is there anything that you know about your history or the history of other white people? And this circumstance?
From that perspective, I see a lot of, what it translates to me as like a lot of callousness, because it's a lack of recognition coming from there. So as far as for myself, what I learned from this, I'm having a very hard time accessing language. It's like my mind is just kind of like buzzing.
Yeah. And just buzzing.
I'm not sure how to say it or get into it.
Thank you. Thank you. And a shared growth experience. Mm-hmm. And a Rosicrucian. Mm-hmm. And heal the sick. And the photo. And your view of the photo. And what happens in your body. And the Rosicrucian. And healing the sick. And a shared growth experience. And I want to take all the time you need to have to the extent that you can, an integration at this level where we're at. This is we're just at the beginning, but I just want you to take all the time you need and to let us know when you're ready to move on to the next part of the process. Okay. Is there any support that you need? Let us know what that is.
Okay. Well, I do feel supported. I have an inkling of something very abstract kind of forming. I think I just need to let it foment. So I am ready to move forward.
Great. It's something abstract, foment. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And Michael,
yeah.
Would you like to go next or would you like me to go next? It's up to you.
No, I think I need to go next.
Okay. And Seth, mm-hmm. would you take the lead here? Do you feel okay with that?
Yeah, can you just...
And I'll support you. You let me know what support you need from me.
Okay, great. Can you just tell me again
the question you asked me? The question I ask is when you view the photo, what happens to your body? Okay. But feel free to do it your own way, because as you notice, I was tracking your experience and using clean language in a very, I don't have the right way to do this. In other words, so feel free to do it your own way with your own style.
Okay.
And I'll support you and let me know if you need any assistance, and I'll be right here for you.
All right, thank you. Are you ready, Michael?
Yes, I am, Seth.
Okay. Well, when you view the photo, what happens to your body?
A very intense cloud of fear, power, raw energy. Being uglily, intensely ugly, perpetrated on another body through another body. And it makes me, the sensation that comes up is actually, it's really hard not to inhabit that power that's coming through in watching the picture. In the multi, it's almost like inhabiting the rays of experience through all the whole picture, the black bodies, the white bodies, the light, the whole thing just is affecting almost every cell in my body.
And affecting almost every cell in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard not to inhabit that. The rays of experience of the picture and an intense cloud of fear and intensely ugly perpetrated on another body.
Through another body.
Through another body. And when it's hard not to inhabit that, is there anything else about it's hard not to inhabit that?
There's a frozenness, which is a form of inhabiting. There's a frozenness. It's a frozen inhabitation. Not inhabiting causes a frozenness that is in itself a form of inhabiting. It's a protection. It's a defense. It's what a turning away. I don't want to see this. I don't want to feel this.
A protection, defense, a turning away, a frozenness. And when frozenness, where is frozenness? Does it have a location?
It's right in front of my eyes, and it's like a sheet of ice that comes from my eyes and covers my heart, all the way down to the bottom of my heart, it's just that sheet from my eyes to my heart of ice.
A sheet of ice from your eyes to your heart.
To the bottom of my heart.
The bottom of your heart. And frozenness. And hard not to inhabit. And sitting with friends on a beach, having a beer, having a serious conversation, like an adult being childlike, and frozenness and inhabit, and childlike. And when an adult being childlike, where is childlike? Does that have a location?
Doesn't exist. There's no childlike, no child could, and my feeling, no child could witness that and survive the witnessing. But that's my feeling.
Feeling, no child could witness that and survive the witnessing.
It's too ugly.
Can I ask a question, Seth?
Of course.
Okay, I can embrace failure here. So it's been not about success or failure, that's for sure. It's about learning at a deeper level than we're used to, probably. A sheet of ice from the eyes to the heart. And when the sheet of ice from the eyes to the heart, what does that heart want to have happen? Thank you. Is this a good place to pause, Michael?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Before it's my turn, I just wanted to reflect a little bit on, this is a meta reflection, how clean language is a tool, and it runs against my instincts as a clean language practitioner to explore what I judge to be, very painful stuff. I immediately like, okay, we can touch it, but let's don't stay there too long before we contact the resources that this person already has. And as I observed that in myself and observed Seth and Michael, and that was exquisite what you were doing, Seth. how we oscillate back and forth from, you know, that what I'm interpreting as a stuck state to something with more resources, but we don't abandon the stuck state. The stuck state is very crucial, I think, to our evolution. Because if we just like hang out on our resources, we'll never touch this stuff.
Right. So
that's what I'm sharing with you guys, my own, and it evokes in me a sense of humility. I really do think it's okay to embrace our failure, to work with this culturally, because too many individuals have worked with it and made breakthroughs, but how much of that has been shared or created, has entered into the nervous systems and the somatic intelligence of large enough people. This is, I think, I'm starting to realize this is my main intention for showing up here today, is that we can evolve at a more accelerated pace than we have, because we're really up against it. So having said all that, I'm really ready and eager.
I would like to add something to what you just said.
Sure.
Ever since I've known you, John, you have been more really open enough to embrace my unskillfulness and my awkwardness across this medium. And it has helped me do the same with on the street, and kind of have a robust, I don't give a fuck if you think this is unskillful or awkward, get real. We're not going to change. If we're always trying to be perfect at doing this, we're not going to learn it.
That's,
so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Deep bows. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to do this, John?
Sure.
Yep. Can I ask you, before we do that, just a clean question about, so we can evolve at a more accelerated pace than we have. And when evolve at a more accelerated pace than we have, is there anything else about pace?
Pace? Yeah, I think that we've had great human beings on this planet who have brought our collective attention to our great potentials. I'm thinking of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the recently deceased Chadwick Boseman. Who was a hero of mine. So we look to our leaders to do for us the heavy lifting. But I don't think we can depend on them anymore. We have to take the leadership and somatically, we have to do this. We have to have settled bodies to do this. So it isn't just about plugging into the genius of a Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or a great actor or a great performer. And of course we need them desperately, no more than ever, to connect to our goodness and our sense of beauty and truth. But we also have to have settled bodies to do this. And I think that what we most admire, I think, about our leaders is that they can step into these highly contentious and conflicted spaces, and their settled bodies can communicate to us a kind of sanity, a basic human capacity that we all have. And even the white bodies who committed these atrocities, I think, are traumatized people. And they had an alternative way. They probably were that was blocked by the the encounter that they were in and their own fear of being ostracized, their own fear of being pointed at. Because if they did defend what was happening, they could get lynched too. White people were lynched also, not just black people. So I think this is runs very, very deep in the white body supremacy. How it's not the evil people we have to worry about, Martin Luther King said, it's the good people who do nothing. I hope that's answered your very insightful, clean question there. Thank you.
Certainly did. So just to track back and then I'll ask the more formal question. So it's not the evil people we have to worry about, it's the good people who do nothing. And white bodies can be ostracized and traumatized too. And sanity communicate to us and settled bodies and our leaders. And so we can evolve at a more accelerated pace than we have. And now, John, when you look at the photo, what happens in your body?
Well, I'm not looking at the photo because I have an inner image of it because I've studied it and it's internalized, so I can see it when I put my eyes closed. And what happens in my body is a learned response, I think, by observing both of you and my own previous readings and study of this text, this exercise is drawing from. So surprisingly, I feel sorrow and compassion for everyone in that photo. Even though I hate what was done. And that those white people are that culture I know extremely well in my bones. I come from those people. And I've had to separate myself from them. But I got out of that culture very early and I got as far away from it as I could. Got out of the Deep South and I came to New York and I found in the East Village a sense of home, like-minded people. Many of them were black people and Asian and Latin and different colors and different cultures. Something that I did not experience in the South where I was raised. So I feel there's that great distance though, and that need to run away from these horrific circumstances and to create a separation isn't going to work anymore. I feel and of course, the city I live in now, there's plenty of bigotry and racism and sexism and homophobia here too. It's just, who do I connect with? And as I am sure in the South, there are people who do not carry lethal amounts of hatred towards the stranger, to those who may be in a weakened situation. So I think this a love of strangers, I think, is something that I'm attempting to cultivate, even though that those, like my father, of course, was a white supremacist, and his body, I come out of his body. And I hated his guts. But I can also sense that he was a very fragile, frightened man. And his cruelty came out of his fear. His inability to trust that the stranger might have a gift for him. So anyway, that's my story. That I'm realizing is not a... there's some historical feelings here, and then some of them are very primary, and it's going back and forth. And luckily, we've established a sense of security in this shared space. So I feel I can go into this liminal zone with some confidence that I won't just, be incapacitated once again, or this just bothers me so much, I'm just going to check out and fast forward into a false security or a freezing. So anyway, it's a nice blend, I think, of the cognitive and the somatic that's happening now. So I'm grateful that I'm having this opportunity to share with you guys at this level, which I usually don't get to in a public space.
And grateful and opportunity and a nice blend of the cognitive and somatic, and can't just check out, and this liminal zone with some confidence and father, and I come out of his body, and a love of strangers I am attempting to cultivate. And this great distance isn't going to work anymore. And no well in my bones, and sorrow and compassion for everyone. And when, with all of this, and a love of strangers, is there anything else about a love of strangers?
Well, I'm getting a flash from all those Bible stories, that I read when I was a little kid, because I love the Bible. I felt safe. Felt safe when I had the Bible, because I had this beautiful Bible. Actually, my parents gave it to me. I still have it here somewhere. But it has these big, bold, beautiful paintings. And I think there's something about, I can't remember, there's a beautiful one. I think, I don't know if it's a parable or what, but Jesus is at the well with the lady of I can't remember where she's from.
Samira?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he's asked her for a drink, and she's complied with his request. And they're from different cultures. I think they're different tribes. And I think she recognizes he's a stranger to the village, and he's made this request. And I think that's a very poignant story for me. And I also remember the one about the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan, who finds a stranger on the road who's been beat up and robbed, and he takes the stranger and he finds a hotel or an inn, and he gets him the medical attention he needs, and when he leaves, he comes back to see how the person has, if the person's recovering, and what further assistance that this stranger needs. So to me, that those are stories that are very ancient, and they go, they're in my bones too. So I feel like I want to embrace all of that wisdom from all the wisdom traditions about how we cultivate our attention so that we can recognize the benefits that come to us from participating in a shared adventure with a stranger, because it could be an ally. This person could be a great soul, and it's always just good for us to exercise our boundaries and go a little bit beyond what we think is safe. Because we feel safe enough, we can then, I think, embrace the potential that could be in a relationship with a stranger, rather than just guard ourselves or put up a defense. And I have lived in this city for a long time, and it is in many ways a city of strangers. But as I talked to Michael in the beginning here, I had a wonderful conversation with a stranger this morning, who gave me a lot of confidence by her response to me, that in her reaching out to me, that we're not alone.
We're not alone. Stranger. And safe enough, we can embrace that potential and exercise our boundaries and participate in a shared adventure with a stranger. And embrace all that wisdom. And it's in my bones too. And love warriors. And skydiver. And is there anything else about
Oh, yeah, actually, that comes from my father. My father, when he was in probably my age, he sent me a letter about an experience he had. He gathered the family. I wasn't there because I lived in New York, but he gathered the family together, and he went skydiving, and he jumped out of a plane. And, you know, it opened
up. Wow.
He landed on the ground, and my mother, of course, was horrified. They'd been divorced for years, but she was screaming hysterically that he was out of his mind. But it was in his letter, it actually was one of the very few moments that I can ever recall that he wrote very well. He wrote a very clear, clear letter to me, and it was important for me to know that he had done this. And it was a ritual. And he just spoke up as he was flying through space. And he says he saw Mother Earth below him, getting closer and closer and closer.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was a moment of a very cruel, vicious man. But he wasn't totally, he's definitely a stranger to me, but he wasn't totally without poetry in him. Which he may have conveyed to me in ways that I'm not particularly aware of, but definitely I'm a lover of a lot of beautiful things and music, and he's like, and I think he sort of, strangely enough, he admired that in me. He told me that in certain ways, which I wasn't able to take in because I hated his guts. So anyway, that's very there is this sort of openness, I suppose, to, and he always said, whenever I complained, as I got older, the opportunities to see him got fewer and fewer. And I got angrier and angrier at him, because I no longer felt I had to keep my mouth shut or they had any power over me. And I clobbered him, not physically, but I psychically, I used every bit of verbal capacity I had to wound him in a way I knew how to do. And I let him know as he had done to me and to many others. So it wasn't like I, you know, felt like I had to, I wasn't going to protect him from anything. And it was great. It was great because he cried. And then he, after he stopped crying, you know, he said, I'm feeling really blue. And then, you know, I said, yeah, cry me a river, Daddy. You know, and that was basically it. And then he died. And I never shed a tear. I felt great because I felt like he can't kick the family dog. He can't punch out my mother. You know, there's no, he can't abuse black people. He's, the world is a safer place because my father's dead. This is what I was thinking. So, and there's a part of me that still thinks that way, but I also feel like this ritual that we've called up the elders in a way. I think the hungry ghosts that I think awakened by studying this photograph together, so that, you know, we have a chance to reorganize, you know, at the somatic level, our so that we just don't have a habitual response, which is impoverishing us, but that we our best potentials, which we probably haven't tapped into very much around these events. You know, we can nurture them. So I certainly feel like I've been given a great accelerated, this has accelerated the pace, I think, for me. And whatever you guys want to do with this, I'm open to, but I really think I would love to move into like the third phase that I had sort of proposed. And that's sort of like an open frame and maybe posing a question, what do you know now that you didn't know before we started this exercise? And what difference does knowing that make? Does that sound like a useful way of framing this next section?
Okay. For me, it does. For
I'm
me.
Getting nods from everybody. Thank you. You know, if we were in the same room, I would be much smoother. But I think because of this technology and looking a flat screen, these little heads, it's sometimes not easy for me to read what's going on.
So John, you're doing a good job. Just to give you feedback. You're doing a good job.
Thank you. So who wants to go first? What? Michael, Seth?
Seth, do you want to go?
Sure, I'll take it. Could you ask the question again?
What do you know now that you didn't know before this session? And what difference does knowing that make?
One thing I did not expect, what do you expect? But a theme seems strange to me, kind of, that I experienced during this session is, I don't even know how to say it. It's almost like fractal stuff, because it was like I would experience something and see it, have it reflected at in all different directions. And for example, when you were talking, John, there were so many levels that I was just seeing in what you were saying coming together in such a story of a very multidimensional story. And I also noticed it was the first in my experience thing that I noticed in this at first was when I was trying to describe looking at the photo, and I just felt all these feelings with no words, and I tried to put them into words. And then when I looked at it again, I saw an externalization of that. I saw that the feelings I was experiencing are the whole scene with each little part was kind of what it was right there in front of me in a different way. And then I realized I was having trouble articulating that. And when I went into that one person's, my perception of this person's perception, I was getting what seemed like blankness also, but it was like an inability to map across and to see in someone else what you see in yourself, or vice versa. And I was, that difficulty in communication, which I was picking up on in the image that I was experiencing also. And then again, when you were just now saying that the screen and the flattening makes it difficult to connect with another person. Because to me, interacting with another person is just the most indescribable and profound thing that basically can happen. Although we generally don't see it that way because we're so used to it and we have all kinds of things that happen, ways that we perhaps articulate it to ourselves as mundane or oppositions that we have or something. So it's such a just intense, stimulating, I guess, divine or indescribable or something thing. And then when there's a reason you can't bridge that gap with someone else, or that perhaps you invert someone else to be completely just opposite of you or something, or deserving of deep ire and violence or something. It's profound. And though I don't know how to articulate right now what I'm going to do going forward with this, I see that this sort of perspective of this awareness in myself, and I'm excited to be with it and be aware of it and reflect on it and cultivate it and allow it to grow in me in the way I interact with others in the world around me.
Thank you. That was beautiful. Fractal stuff. Reflected at and from different directions and multi-dimensional and intense and stimulating and divine and profound. Thank you very much, Seth. And Michael.
John, why don't you go? I'll go last this time.
Okay, sure. Could someone ask that question of me? What was it? What
do I know? You do it, Seth.
What do I know now that I didn't know at the beginning of this session? Mm-hmm. And what difference does knowing that make?
Yeah, that's it.
I think the I didn't expect, there were some surprises, because I didn't expect that I would be able to go that deep that fast into a process in like this format, but I know Seth very well, and Seth and I have done lots of modeling together. And I know Michael, although I've never met him in the flesh, I know him very well from many episodes here online. So I guess that's what I find, what I know now is that it's possible, certainly desirable, that people can come together using this technology and in creative ways that don't fragment us further, but actually can help us integrate what is so difficult for us to deal with right now, which seems to be our isolation, the fact that we have to wear masks when we're in public, the dilemmas of who to trust, who to believe, so much misinformation. And, you know, I met Seth in the park a week ago. We had a beautiful afternoon. And I think there's something wonderful about that and indispensable about those face-to-face contacts in the real-time, real world. Yet I'm also encouraged that we can come together in these kind of virtual spaces and make sense together. And that's extremely important, because so much of what I observe and what I often find in these virtual spaces is much, I feel when they're over, just as confused as I was at the beginning of it. And some interesting ideas might be shared, but it stays pretty cognitive. And I feel very little actual investigation of a cultural shadow ever in these virtual spaces. Not that before these virtual spaces we were particularly good at exploring the shadow together. I don't think we were. I don't think we're getting. So that's why I'm heartened, and that's why I feel like I'm learning something about. We have a new skill set that we can, hone our skills here and make, change our body minds in very direct ways and resonate with one another and move forward, take that out into the mean streets wherever we are. Maybe those streets aren't so mean. Maybe it's just an idea I take with me. But there may be lots of strangers out there who I could engage with and resonate with. So I'm encouraged that that can happen. So thank you, nice. Both of you.
Nice, nice. Mm. Can one of you ask me the question? Because I can't remember it.
You remember it, Seth? I can remember it. I've had practice. Okay, Michael. I've forgotten it. What is it? Knowing what you know now.
Yeah.
What do you know now that you didn't know before this session? And what difference does knowing that make?
Well, first of all, what I know now that I didn't know is how important it is to have that safe enough experience within my own bodies and the experience of my own body to have that safe enough experience for myself without depending on other people outside of myself. Because relationally, I've experienced both sides. I've experienced being safe enough with the others, but also, fuck no, I don't want to be near you. You're a fucking asshole. You know, that there's a risk. There's that edge of risk of, like you were saying, John, of the stranger. Well, like Carney says, hospitality used to be interpreted with both of being a host and sensing the hostility that might be present in another. So what I've learned from articulating and listening to your stories is again, I think, goes to learning that intelligent line of how to use our defense, our biological defense systems, and grow with it and beyond it. We need it. We don't need to deny it and trash talk it, but we move from a sense of honoring its intelligence to the wisdom of how to use it, when not to use it. I mean, I've experienced times that, no, I perceived a threat that wasn't there, but then I've also not perceived a threat that was there. And so that's what I've learned now of how important that kind of relational to my own biological soma, you know, and that soma is also, and you always say this, and I love it, is set in an environment. It's not, the separation is only for orientation. It's not real, you know, in a sense. It's useful, you know, it functions, but it's not totally real. And so, what's the second part of the question again? Can you say this?
What difference does knowing that make?
Oh, the difference that it makes is how I begin to be actually, to practice being settled in this body when I'm around other bodies, to the point, if I work with it and cultivate it, as to use your word, John, I can be with somebody that's upset. And maybe in some subtle way, I notice they're upset. I notice, and I don't necessarily have to like it, but the more, like you said, leaders know how to embody that. And I think you're right. We need to stop making our leaders our caretakers so much. Yes, we need them, but we tend to project a caretaking attitude onto it. And I'm not trying to, we need leaders to help at that level. But down here, we need to learn how to do it in a way for ourselves so that I can be in the midst. And what I've learned just how much being a bouncer kind of just planted the seeds of having to do that. When I have to tell somebody, you're being drunk, you're being rude, and you need to get the fuck out of here. But I got to do it in a certain way. I may be thinking words, get the fuck out of here, but I can't. I have to apply it with finesse, if possible.
That's right.
And until, if it's a 1, 2, 3, until they cross a line, I'm going, okay, as Rule Paul used to say, I come from a place of love, but sometimes you have to break it down to the motherfucker.
That's right.
You know? That's so right. But I think it is a cultivated discernment of that oscillation between the two so that you don't get caught so much of the pendulum, you know, you know, it's more of a, I don't know how to describe it, but it's not such a, it's an oscillation without the pendulum.
That's right. That's right. So, I love that. I love that. I'm learning also more differences because there's something about what you just said, that oscillating without turning into a pendulum. I'm losing the train of my thought, but it has something to do with, well, I'll let anyone else talk. It'll come back to me. I know. I just have to relax around.
It'll come back.
But I had some insight into a dynamic that is very common about these liminal zones and how, you know, it's like a dream you had last night. And you better, if you had a dream, you better write it down right away because it vanishes quickly. Whatever insight or flash of truth or beauty you got in that dream, it goes quickly. So we're very state, where our knowledge is very bound up in the states that we're in.
And I'm glad you're saying that because what I think we're talking about is learning not to be bound up in the state and feel the vibrational shift ahead of kind of just become more sensitive to the shift of the vibrational. Oh, I'm moving into a liminal zone, kind of like, I'm just using this analogy. Oh, I can see when I cross over from a desert into a forest, or I go from the, you know, down to the beach from, you know, that's why I practice as a ritual when I do the labyrinth. I bow to both sides of the threshold, both sides of the thresholds, because it brings my attention. I cultivate a certain type of attention to what they were talking about of this being with thresholds.
That's right. And you brought back to me what I wanted to say about thresholds and catharsis and states. And how we could bring with us the dark side of our childhood, like the being in Alabama, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where more black people were lynched in that neighborhood than the rest of the South put together. This is something I got from a novel written by James Baldwin. This is very new information for me, but I remember the vibe. And it was a very strong one. I was very young and I was soaking it up like a sponge. But you can carry that with you. Mm-hmm. So it's not in a location anymore. It's in my psyche soma. And I'm realizing I don't need to be, my nervous system doesn't have to be hijacked.
No.
And the threshold of tears, you know, there are good tears and there are bad tears. There's the kind of tears you share when you're pitching a fit and you want attention, like that terrible two. But then the nervous system is actually, certain kinds of tears can come up. They don't overwhelm you. Maybe a few tears will drop, but it immediately has a soothing effect on the nervous system. Sort of like that's the way the nervous system processes and integrates through laughter and tears. You know?
I'm glad you brought that up because I have a daughter, 28, that's on the front line at the county hospital in the ICU unit for COVID. She's lost some patients. And one of the things that she does is she cries, and I totally support her crying.
Right.
Some members of the family, I'll put it diplomatically, have a hard time of being witness to her crying because I think this is where having a settled body and helps you not to react to somebody else's maybe defense system of not being willing to feel into another person's space.
That's excellent. So we're getting ready to wrap up. I think we have a few more minutes. And we are recording. So we'll post this. That feels comfortable with everybody that we're going to post
this? I'm extremely comfortable because I hope we get plenty of people giving us their feedback of how they feel about it.
Yeah, and it is my heartfelt wish that this the merit of our work today is shared with all sentient beings.
Yes.
That this public-private thing, we need to renegotiate that.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. So that it's not a do away with either side. We just have to renegotiate it.
That's
right. Yeah. We'll see.
Anything else that you gentlemen want to share before we... What happens next, Seth?
Just the thought I have in my mind is about sharing and the nature of sharing and sharing in something with others and how much of yourself you're able to share and when it's appropriate. And one thing I thought that was interesting before when I was listening to was Resmi.
Resma, yeah. Manakim.
Yeah, he was talking about, as far as I understood it, it was kind of this idea that the concept of race and racial superiority that we have today, if you look at where it came from, the way it kind of fell on my ears when he was describing it was it's as if there's a form of, I don't think the word oppression is the best word, but I'm just going to use it just for lack of a better one right now, but there was an oppression happening that then got transferred and made into a new kind between people. And I mean, I think we're always sharing, even when we think we're not sharing, we're sharing the fact that we're keeping something, right? And the way we relate to each other. And if we are unable to recognize a deeper root between us, then we can share an intense and ugly difference. And I just hope.
Yes. Yes.
That we can learn to share responsibility.
I think rather than blame, we don't have to.
Blame or shame game. I think this is also really moving our consciousness into maybe reintegrating the soma because it's an energy field, and so it's not just about dropping down into the biological survival mechanism. There's energy in there that we need to touch in and learn how better to use, as much as the mental energy that comes from the cognitive. That's it's true. All energy, but the mental tends to break it into categories and then think the categories are real. Well, fuck no, they're not real. They're just frames of reference.
Right. And the subtle realms, which interpenetrate these dense physical bodies. These dense physical bodies are extremely important. We are a portal. The body is a portal for interdimensional travel. So we can use our imaginations and those subtle ranges of our experience in incredibly creative ways or destructive. I mean, the subtle can be extremely destructive as well, because we can be haunted by these unresolved conflicts from persons who've been, you know, passed on decades and decades and centuries before us.
And John, I just want to support what you're saying, but I guess I come from a place of doing it, working with the subtle in the gross realm of how am I on this planet Earth working with the strange energies, not to dismiss what you're saying, because I think that's a component, but how do you do that unless you've learned kind of, it's like you got to learn this lesson to move to the next, you know? And sometimes I think we've lost touch, like David Ambron talks of the spell of the sensuous. He very much lays out that I think that includes your argument, but trying to ground people in their own planet, how their bodies are sensing subtly the environment that surrounds their body.
That's right. And I can't agree with you more. I think we need to do both.
Yes. No, no. Yeah, exactly. I could just come from the place that I see so much people that are frightened of even that gross realm.
That's right. And I'm very aware of spiritual bypassing is a very tendency, especially among meditators. But I think it comes, that kind of spiritual bypassing comes from dissociation. And I think dissociation is triggered almost without awareness. But I think if you can be aware of that, oh, I'm using my spiritual practice to check out. Just beam me out of here.
You know? Actually, John, you make a good point. Is part of the practice, at least, I totally agree with you. Some spiritual meditators do that spiritual bypassing ship. Yeah. But I come from the place, and I think I'm influenced from Reggie, of, no, let's pay attention to that disassociation. There must be a reason. There must be an intelligence to that.
Sure.
But we may not have a wisdom of how to work with it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And if someone's beating the shit out of you,
and you're going to disassociate,
you thank God you're able to float up out of your body and watch it from the corner of the room.
That's right.
John. And then when the beating is over, you can come back to the body. This is what I learned from working with David Grove, because his primary question when he works with a client is, and he worked with a lot of violent people who have been subjected to a lot of violence, is when you dissociate, where do you go?
Yes, right.
And that was a brilliant question, because when he asked me that question, I said, oh, it's over there.
Yeah.
It's in the corner of the room, and he asked me to go there. He said, okay, go there. I went, well, it's up above in the corner. He said, well, we'll get you a chair. So he had me stand on the chair.
See, that's working with the experience rather than just letting it work you. And then Peter Levine's work and the polyvagal helps you go, okay, well, that was necessary. Now, though, let's not stay stuck there.
That's right. I just want to point out something, though, and this is a big topic, and maybe we can continue this in another call, because I think we've barely scratched the surface here, but dissociative states can be produced by trauma.
Yes.
But also, genius comes from dissociated states. I mean, being able to, great performers, actors, writers, if you write a really good story, the person who's reading it will enter into the psyche and the soma of another. So where is that happening? It's happening in subtle realms. And that's that's a genius or a great performers who are working with music, very abstract levels, but they can make it very concrete. So I'm saying dissociation is not something we should try to correct, but to explore in a creative way.
Yes, right.
To turn it into a pathology.
Let's not turn it in, any of our experience into a pathology, but it can, we have to be aware the way we're relating to the experience can be a pathology, the way we're relating to the experience. And the way you just explained that, it just, well, with geniuses, what's the difference between a dissociative state and transcending?
We can do that too, yeah.
But I mean, it seems like that dissociative could be just an awkward word to, oh, I'm moving beyond. I'm letting it come through me.
Yeah, I think we're imminent and we are transcendent beings. And
yes,
I think
exactly.
You can't favor either one without getting into trouble. But if you're both and, you can, I think, work with whatever comes at you. And I'm so glad we did this today. I'm getting ready to wrap it up.
Okay.
So we have a time frame here. And I'm, you know, we're going to post this, and I wanted to call it Cultural Somatics, Working with White Body Supremacy. And whatever comments you guys would like to me to include in that, so that the persons who might watch this have a clue to what we're doing here. So this is very experiential. And there may be, we may follow this up, I hope, with other adventures like this. Because I feel like, you know, it's a creation. We're doing a collaborative sort of research creation. I believe we're creating research. And I think we can go at it in many different ways. And
John, I just want to maybe promote from Resman's book. I think he does a, you know, promotes that, you know, white people need to work on their own shit.
That's right.
And I feel this is three white dudes working on their own shit. So that we can unhook, or whatever you want to call it, from the very powerful abstraction, or I don't know what to call it, of white body supremacy.
That's right.
I'm white, but I'm not supreme to any other human beings.
That's right.
I'm not supreme. I may have certain talents that are at a different level than people, but as a human being, color doesn't come into it.
Well, if there's
in a sense.
Yeah, I'm also finishing up his book, and he's giving some recommendations for white bodies, saying, don't try to get rid of that
white body,
not the white body supremacy, but the privilege that comes, but try to share it with as many people as you can. Mm-hmm. So if you see a black person who the store, the manager of the store or whoever isn't waiting on that person, but is waiting on you instead because you're a white person and they notice you and they're not noticing the black person, just say gently, oh, I think that person over there was here before me. You know, it's a very simple gesture.
Yeah, he makes it very, those small little things of so that the white body does not, it stops being complicit with this kind of behavior. But he makes it clear, you do your best to do it gently,
without blaming anybody,
and you just deal with it. In my experience, you start just like with the bouncer. I start off very gentle. Just see how the energy flows. Depending on how the energy flow, then my system decides to calibrate. And most of the time, the lowest level is fine. It's only the rare occasion that I have to calibrate it from a slap in the face to a fucking fist to the face. Only occasionally.
That's right. I love you guys. Blessings.
I love you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Have a good time, and I can't wait to see this and see the show.
And when we post it, I'll give you guys a link to it, and I hope we'll have conversations about this.
Yeah. I hope so too, John. This has been very good and very helpful for me. Thank you.
I hope to see you at the park real soon, Seth. I wish you could.
Nice.
Thank you.